Session number 12778.
Martin Reel 16.
To see whether there's anything we could do to help them, to make them move easier. At the end of the meeting, one of the quartermasters rose to his feet and said to me, "Colonel, I know that my commanding officer would wish me to express our appreciation of the wonderful support given to us by the British Army in the Kalia Sovereign Base area. No words could be too high to express our feelings, and thank you very, very much indeed." Whereupon the other quartermaster got to his feet and said, "Colonel, I know that our commanding officer would wish to express exactly the same sentiments, but his sentiments would be sincere." I don't think he meant it like that, but it was quite amusing. And during that time, when they were quite close to the Sovereign Base area, I used to have the colonels of the Irish battalions and some of their officers in for curry lunches on Sundays. And inevitably we would talk about the Irish problem. And they felt, of course, that there should be a united Ireland. And I said that I couldn't see the Northern Irish agreeing to that, which would be a great sacrifice on their part, without some similar sacrifice on the part of the Southern Irish. And the solution which we came up with, and this was way back now in 1964, was that there should be a united Ireland, but within the Commonwealth, recognising the Queen as head of state, as head of the Commonwealth. And that they seem to think would be acceptable. I just mentioned that because it is now many, many years later, and the Northern Ireland problem goes on without any apparent source of any apparent end to it. The Danes, we found, they were equipped with armed cars, ferrets. They were more British than the British. They all wore black berets. They were indistinguishable from the British. They all spoke English, and they were very pro-British in their outlook. The Finns were great people. We built sauna bars for them, for their camps. There was a slight disaster when they first arrived, because we issued them all with brand new cooking equipment, all of which had been preserved in mineral jelly, which they didn't appreciate had to be cleaned off before any cooking took place, so that they were rather ghastly tummy troubles to start with. And they came fully equipped with bicycles, and if you visited their camps, they delighted in showing you a bicycle action, when a company would bicycle down the road towards you, and then suddenly hurl itself off its bicycles, and open fire on an imagined enemy. We found them very, very nice people to deal with. The Austrians supplied a field hospital, despite the fact that we had this superb modern hospital in Deconia. And up the time I left, they had only one patient, while the British military hospital had 300. The one patient was one of their own soldiers who broke his ankle playing football, which was all the Austrian hospital really had to do. And finally, there was the British contingent. And Percy Blake and his inner skinnings became part of the British contingent. And I heard one day that there had been a shooting incident down at his camp, which was near Larnaca. And and that one of his soldiers had gone berserk and had started firing his rifle off people. So I went down there to see Percy, and I found him sitting at his desk, white with anger. And I said to him, "Come on, Percy, cheer up. I mean, it's not as if somebody was hurt." He said, "That is exactly the point. A so-called trained soldier with a Bren gun and 28 rounds of ammunition, and he couldn't even hit his company sergeant major." He was a great man. We had to produce all sorts of special supplies for this United Nations force. I think we had to import some 50 different types of food to meet individual national needs. We had a great difficulty with the Canadians and a lot of quite amusing correspondence on the subject of lavatory paper. The British paper at that time was made of a somewhat hard, shiny material, very durable, and as Canadians said, it would have been superb for the use for writing underwater, and that wasn't really its purpose, and they wanted something rather more civilized, which they eventually got. We had to make all sorts of different breads from our bakery, from the army bakery, rye loaves and special Canadian white loaf and so on. And we spent vast amounts of money on eggs and vegetables on the local market. We, as the winter approached, we had to provide oil stoves for all the tents, and we had to get those from all over the world. We had a great deal of trouble finding Union Jacks to fly on our own vehicles to differentiate us from anybody else. I know that posed quite a problem to the Ministry of Defence. And so we went on, and we were told initially that this support of the United Nations was to last for 3 months, and then it was renewed, and then it became renewable every 6 months, and I think that is still the position today in 1992, which is, 28 years ago. So you never know what you're taking on when you start a United Nations operation. But there's no doubt about it that the support coming from the British logistic base did enable people to be received in a comfort which they'd never had before and to be operational in double quick time. While I was still serving in Cyprus, I got the exciting news that I was going to be given command of 48 Gurkha Brigade in Hong Kong in February 1966. And I felt this was a special honour, not being a Gurkha myself. And I knew that one of the other brigade commanders in Hong Kong was a Gurkha officer who I had been with at Sandhurst as a cadet, and who was getting the less exciting job, or as it seemed to me then, the less exciting job of internal security in Hong Kong itself, whereas my brigade was stationed up in the New Territories. I went out there in February 1966. I had previously gone to the Army School of Education at Beaconsfield and asked them whether they could teach me Gurkhali. They asked me how long I had, and I said about 5 days, and they said they could only teach me about 24 useful phrases if I was to write out in English what I wanted. So I wrote out, I think, questions like, when did you last fire your rifle? Are you married? How many children have you got? I learnt these off by heart in Gurkhani. And I was to find when I got to Hong Kong that although these questions went across perfectly well and were understood, I could not, of course, understand the answers. So that Gurkha soldiers would look in utter astonishment when, having asked them whether they were married, and they had replied no, I then asked them how many children they had. But I got more experience with this after a time, so that if I asked them when they last fired their rifle, I would then turn to the officer accompanying me and raise my eyebrows, and he would then say, yes sir, I'm afraid we haven't fired our rifle some time, but we're on the range tomorrow. Or he would say, yes, we always fire our rifles 10 times a week, or whatever it was, so one was able to get away with it. However, that is jumping the gun a bit. Before I actually left for Hong Kong, I went to the Commonwealth Office, from the Commonwealth Office, for a briefing on the situation. And having been told before I went to Cyprus that everything was dead quiet out there, and I could not expect any excitement, I said to the people in the FCO, are you expecting any trouble in Hong Kong? And they said, no, none at all, very peaceful. So I wondered. I got out there, and I found, in fact, that most of my brigade was away in Borneo on operations. And I went on a visit to Borneo, and I remember speaking to an officer of one of my battalions, who at that moment was in Indonesia, deep inside Indonesian territory, on the edge of a football ground, which he had decided to ambush when the military teams, Indonesian army teams based there, came to play a football match. This was a time during confrontation with Indonesia. But he decided while I was listening in that I have an idea that the match was called off or something. Anyhow, it didn't take place. But not very long after that, confrontation with Indonesia ceased, and the whole 48th Brigade, initially consisting of the 1st, 2nd, 1st, 6th and 1st, 10th Gurkha Rifles, concentrated in Hong Kong. And I then started the business of trying to get to know them. We had a number of quite exciting exercises. I like to try and bring surprise into all the exercises which I planned. I can remember one in which battalion was at short notice to move, and I invited the commanding officer and his company commanders to a cocktail party to meet the governor of one of the Pacific Islands, who was staying in Hong Kong with our governor at the time, and who I was having to entertain. So they all came looking very suspicious to my cocktail party, which was attended by all the local civilians as well. The so-called governor was actually an officer in the Royal Marines on temporary attachment in Hong Kong, who did a superlative job of being a governor, to the extent that the commanding officer of the Gurkha battalion, who was being exercised, called him sir throughout the evening. And everyone was happy, you know, we had our drinks. And the governor then left to depart. I went to see him off, and a few moments later staggered back into the room where the cocktail party was being held, having been hit over the head and blood pouring down my face, and saying the governor has been kidnapped, rescue him. And that was the start of the exercise. And I think that's an exercise which the first six Gurkha rifles will always remember. And there were various other exercises. I remember finishing another exercise as the first 10th Gurkha rifles, who knew that the main brigade exercise was going to end in an hour's time and had relaxed, and were suddenly attacked by two battalions of black pyjamaed soldiers representing the sort of Viet Cong type of enemy who we were, most of our exercises were designed against in those days. So all that was quite good fun. But way back in China, the Cultural Revolution, which had started earlier that year, was beginning to get closer and closer to the border. And the Cultural Revolution was really started by Chairman Mao, who had come to the conclusion that all the people of his generation who had taken part in the Long March and so on had become old and soft and had lost their revolutionary fervour, and that to get the revolution really going again and not to sort of going downhill like as in Russia, it meant stirring and getting the youth, who are always in any country, I think, anti-establishment or inclined to be, get them cracking. And so they started rampaging all over China, causing absolute havoc, as one knows. And by early 1967, that trouble was spreading down onto the Chinese border. Now, the border between Hong Kong and China is about 17 miles long, and it starts in Deep Bay in the west and runs to Mears Bay in the east, part of it along the line of the Shumchun River and part through mountains, which are rather like the sort of Cairngorms in Scotland, quite high mountains. Across this border, at that time, there were four main crossing places. The most important was Lo Wu, which was the only international crossing point. And here, passengers and goods arrived by train from China. Passengers had to get out of their trains, come across the bridge, and then go through our own immigration department before getting on to a Hong Kong train to take them down to Kowloon. Goods, on the whole, came across on goods trains all the way from China, and this was mostly foodstuffs, and went right down into Kowloon without changing. But this was an international crossing point, and the one and only international point. And at the same crossing point came farmers from the Chinese side who owned land or farmed land on our side of the border and had done so for generations. Along the border a bit towards the east was a Bailey Bridge across the river, across the Shumchun River, at a place called Man Kam To. This bridge had been put up by the Hong Kong government, and across this bridge every day came farmers to work their fields, and more importantly, porters wheeling trolleys of livestock and vegetables. And this was really the main supply point for Hong Kong. And the lorries were brought into this large compound, where there were one or two government huts and so on, and a small police station right down by the Bailey Bridge, and transferred then onto the lorries of the Man Loon Transport Company, which drove them down into Hong Kong. And the porters and farmers then went back across the island. their own side of the bridge. A little further down the border was a footbridge across the river at a place called Taku Ling, where everyday farmers came across to farm the land on our side of the border. And finally, at the extreme east end, there was a fishing village called Chateau Coq, which had a main street running through the middle, down which went boundary stones marking the division of China from Hong Kong. So it was only the boundary stones which marked the division. There was nothing to stop people crossing freely from one side of the street to the other. And in fact, people who lived on one side might have brothers and sisters on the other side. And there was a fish pier in Chateau Coq, where both sides, Chinese and Hong Kong fishermen, landed their catches, which were then sent down to the Hong Kong government fish market. And in Chateau Coq, the only thing which would strike one in those days was that there were very few young men on our side of the border, because practically all of them work in Chinese restaurants in UK. At this time, on the Chinese side of the border, there was a regiment called 30 Border Regiment, which was the was supposed to look after the border and principally to try and stop refugees from China escaping into Hong Kong. It was the equivalent of in strength of British Brigade, but like most border organisations, wasn't of very high calibre and equipped only with small arms. And it consisted of elderly men who had little enthusiasm for soldiering and young men who were very aggressive. To help 30 border regiments in the task was the militia, which was the equivalent of our territorial army, to which every able-bodied man in the border area belonged and which did regular military training and was sent away, in fact, for a sort of fortnight's camp every year and that sort of thing. And what we didn't realise at this time was that all the nice old farmers and people who came across to farm their land on our side were actually members of the militia as well. And then finally, lying back from the border a short distance, was 42 Army, consisting of about 40,000 soldiers who, at the drop of a hat, were capable of launching an attack across the border into Hong Kong. On our side, by May 1967, we had the Frontier Division of the New Territories Police Force, about 350 policemen manned police stations and frontier OPs along the length of the land border. The army in the New Territories consisted of 48 Gurkha Brigade, with three battalions, 1st 6th, the 1st 7th and the 1st 10th Gurkha Rifles, a squadron of the Life Guards with armoured cars, and 18 Light Regiment RA, which, although it was a light regiment, also had a battery of medium guns as part of its equipment. Now, we had, although we were fairly close to the border, we were never allowed to go anywhere near it for fear of stirring up friction on the other side by the appearance of armed soldiers up on the border. So we had one battalion which was called the Frontier Battalion, and which was directly in support of the police all along the border, but wasn't allowed to go anywhere near the frontier. And the rest of my brigade was on call to Kowloon and Hong Kong for internal security duties down there. People on both sides of the border, tough, independent, proud, arrogant, like farmers anywhere in the world. As the Cultural Revolution grew closer and closer to the border. It first of all, in early 67, hit Macau, the Portuguese colony just down the China Sea. And the Portuguese government kowtowed to all demands on it. And while they were allowed to remain as figureheads of the government, in fact, all authority was taken over by the Chinese communists in Macau. In Hong Kong, we began to notice changes along the border. The farmers from the other side no longer dribbled across to work on their fields in ones and twos, but marched in form platoons, carrying banners and portraits of Chairman Mao, and chanting revolutionary songs. When they got to their place of work, they then held a prayer meeting in which they would shout the thoughts of Chairman Mao, wave his little red book on high, and before starting work. And they started shouting insults at the Hong Kong police manning the frontier posts. And in the village of Shantikok, although we were never told this at the time, the police had to withdraw from some of their posts because they were heavily stoned. Now, there was nothing illegal in shouting and chanting and displaying banners and posters and slogans. And so the police up in the border area, bowing like bamboos in the wind, as they all want to tell us, attempted to keep out of direct confrontation with these very militant peasants. And down in the cities of Hong Kong, the same sort of pattern emerged. Parties of workers would hold prayer meetings outside the gates of their factories, marched through the streets, waving their red books. And then in late April of 67, there was a minor industrial dispute, trade union dispute, in a plastic flour factory in Kowloon. And this was the moment the communists decided to cash in on this dispute and to attempt to take over in Hong Kong, just as they had done in Macau. Well, throughout late April, May and June, the Hong Kong police were very hard-pressed to maintain law in the cities, although things remained fairly peaceful in the new territories. The government did give way to a lot of the aggravation down in Hong Kong, because they didn't want to excite the Chinese government in Peking, so they allowed things to go on which it wouldn't normally have been allowed to happen in any properly organized place. I've said that on the border it was fairly quiet, but in May they started a new activity. Every Saturday morning, meetings took place in the small town of Shom Chun on the Chinese side of the border. We could hear the loudspeakers blaring away, and